Lecture 45, Animal Mummies.
Welcome back again. Remember last time we started talking about the Ptolemies and we got into the bad Ptolemies after Ptolemy III, it's kind of all downhill. And if you remember Ptolemy VIII, the one called Physicon, Fatty, he started building a temple at Komombo, which was dedicated to Sobek, the crocodile god. Well, the Ptolemies were fascinated with animals, especially animal mummies. And what I'd like to do for this lecture is I'd like to detour a little bit, take a side trip from the Ptolemies, the chronological Ptolemies. As you've seen last time, too many Ptolemies can be lethal. And I'd like to talk about animal mummies during the Ptolemaic period and about animal mummies in general, because they're usually misunderstood. Let me first tell you why Egyptians and the Ptolemies mummified animals. There are really four reasons, four very different reasons why animals were mummified. You know, all animal mummies are not the same. First, animals were sometimes placed in tombs as food for the deceased. That's one reason. Also, sometimes pets were mummified. You know, you could take Fido to the next world with you. So that's a completely different reason from the first one. Now, a third reason was animals were sacrificed to the gods and were mummified as offerings. That's another reason for animal mummification. And the fourth, and the rarest, and probably the most interesting, was sometimes an animal was viewed as a god. And when he died, he was preserved and buried like a god. Now, let's start with animals as gods. Now, this is something that there's a little bit of a debate among Egyptologists about, but I think most agree with this position, and it'll surprise you. The ancient Egyptians didn't worship animals. That's what most Egyptologists say. The ancient Egyptians did not worship animals. The proper way to sort of describe the relationship between animals and gods was as follows, they would say. The average cat in the street was not viewed as a god. The average dog was not considered a god. These were not all little gods. For certain gods, an animal was associated with that god. So, for example, Bastet, who was indeed a goddess, was shown as a woman with the head of a cat. So Bastet is our cat goddess. But not every cat was Bastet. So in some ways, Bastet would have had a soft spot in her heart for cats, but not every cat in the street was viewed by the Egyptians as a god. Now, most Egyptologists say, as broadly as you can possibly say, the Egyptians did not worship animals. Now, I feel that there is one exception. See, I agree with most Egyptologists that the average animal was not viewed as a god. Think how confusing it would be. What would happen? No. But I think there was one case where certainly an animal was worshipped. And that's what I want to talk about first. The case where a god dies and is preserved as a mummy. It's the Apis bull. Now, we have talked several times about this Apis bull. And I've mentioned it's a sacred bull that when it died, it was buried in a place at Saqqara called the Serapeum, which is the burial place of the Apis bull. And as you know by now, Serapeum is a corruption of two Egyptian words, Osir, which is Osiris, Ap, which is Apis, and when the Apis died, it's called the Osiris Apis, Osirap, and then it gets corrupted to Osirapium, and we get the Serapeum. Now, why do I say the Apis was a god if all the other animals weren't? It was treated very specially. Let me tell you how they believed the Apis was born. Lightning came from the heavens, struck a cow, conceiving the Apis, and then the Apis is born. So it is part god, part terrestrial beast. Right? Now that is how you get an apis. The apis had special markings. It had a diamond on its forehead, diamond shape on its forehead. It had a scarab shape under its tongue. It had wings on its back. And one other little detail we're given, its tail hairs were doubled at the ends. I don't know, sounds like split ends, right? But that's the distinguishing markings of the apis. Now, one of the people who tells us about this is our man, Herodotus, right? Our Greek tourist, and he describes an apis. Interestingly, by the way, Herodotus is pretty accurate. We have bronze statues of the apis bull from ancient times. These were little offerings that people would leave in temples. You know, a bronze statue, maybe a foot across, of a bull. And they're nicely done, detailed. Many of them are from Ptolemaic times, from the time of the Ptolemies. And on the back, you will see wings. And on the forehead, you will see a diamond. So it looks like these really were the markings by which the apis was distinguished. Now, as you know, the Egyptians were resurrectionists. They didn't believe in reincarnation. You know, that's kind of, a lot of New Agers talk about ancient Egyptians being reincarnated and that kind of thing. No. The Egyptians were resurrectionists. They believed their body was going to get up and go again in the next world. But if you follow me with the apis, it is as close to reincarnation as you ever get in ancient Egypt. I think it's almost reincarnation. The reason I say that is when the apis was born, it lived in a temple. It was pampered, perfumed, given everything it wanted. But there was only one apis alive at any one time. When the apis died, perhaps after 20 years, perhaps after 30, the search went on for the new apis. It's almost as if the apis reincarnates, and the way you find the new apis is by the markings. It's very similar, by the way, to the way the Dalai Lama, the ruler of Tibet, is selected. The belief is that when the Dalai Lama dies, he will reincarnate. And his incarnation will be found as a child who has certain distinguishing factors, the long earlobes of a Buddha, that kind of thing. So it's very much like that, and it's very, very, very close to reincarnation. Now, the reason I say it's obvious, I think, that the Egyptians worshipped the apis, because this wasn't an ordinary bull. It was conceived from the heavens. It was kept in a temple, pampered, perfumed. And when the apis died, it was mummified like a god. It was treated as you would treat a god. Remember I said that we have no papyrus that tells us how to mummify a human? Out of the millions of humans that were mummified, there's not a single papyrus giving us the surgical procedures that tells us how to do it. Well, there is one papyrus that deals with surgical procedures and the nuts and bolts of mummification. It tells us how to mummify an apis bull. There is a papyrus that gives, if you wanted to mummify an apis bull, you could follow the instructions and you'd have a mummified bull. Now, why would they write down how to mummify an apis bull, but not write down how to mummify a human? I'll give you my theory. I think it's probably right. You didn't have to write down how to mummify a human, because if somebody died, there was always somebody alive, an embalmer, who had mummified somebody. Somebody was always around who knew how to mummify. It was father to son, and they were hundreds of embalmers, hundreds throughout Egypt. But the apis bull, only one alive at any one time, could live for 30 years. And perhaps when that apis died, the last person who had mummified the last apis bull, the embalmer who had mummified the last apis bull, maybe he's dead. And now there's no one alive who knows how to mummify the apis. So they wrote it down in great detail. For example, it says that when you're mummifying it, the apis should be clamped to a board, a mummification board, with 22 clamps. It gives us the number of clamps. It tells us what priests should be present. It even gives us the names of the bandages, magical names for the bandages. And it tells us in what order we place those bandages around the mummy. And when it refers to the mummy, it says, wrap the god's skull, wrap the god's leg. So clearly, this is a god who's being mummified. It's a unique situation in Egypt. I think it's the only case where I'm really quite certain that an animal was worshipped. Now, let me say something about the discovery of the Serapeum. I want you to get a feeling for just how important this Apis bull was to Egypt. It seemed to be associated with fertility, so the Apis is really central to the well-being of Egypt. The Serapeum was lost for thousands of years. Nobody knew where it was. It had been mentioned by ancient travelers. Strabo, the geographer, mentioned seeing it. He even mentioned that an avenue of sphinxes led up to the Serapeum. But it disappeared from history, covered by the sands. Enter Auguste Mariette, a young Egyptologist, Frenchman, 1850s. He is sent to Egypt by the French government to buy Coptic manuscripts. They are building a library of Egyptian papyri, and they want Coptic manuscripts, the late form of the Egyptian writing. And he's supposed to go to monasteries where Coptic manuscripts were kept and buy them. He's sent with cash, money in hand. He's red-taped. He goes to Egypt, and they're not selling him to him. They say later, maybe later. And he winds up waiting and waiting for months. Now, Mariette is educated, knows a little Egyptology. Nobody had a degree in it then, of course. And he starts visiting antiquity dealers, shops in Cairo. And he sees fairly large sphinxes. Almost all the shops had them. They must have been pretty common. And he asked, where did you get these sphinxes? And they all said, Saqqara. So Mariette, remembering Strabo, who said an avenue of sphinxes led to the Serapeum, figures if he could find where these sphinxes came from, maybe they will lead him to the burial place of the sacred Apis bull. So he goes to Saqqara and indeed finds the sphinxes at Saqqara. And he completely forgets about his Coptic manuscripts, takes the money they've given him, hires workmen, and starts excavating. Right? This was the good old days of Egyptology when you could do anything, practically anything. His workmen excavate, and he finds the Serapeum, the burial place of the sacred Apis bulls. Now, it's a unique burial. It's chamber after chamber. It's not just one tomb for an Apis bull. It's many chambers, because every 20 or 30 years or so, there is an Apis that would die. And as a new Apis died, they would prepare a new chamber for that bull. So you have, it's a wonderful place to visit. Wonderful. It's kind of atmospheric. You get a feeling you're back in the ancient world. You go through caverns, long tunnels, and on the right and on the left are big chambers. By big, I'd say it's the size of a living room, a large living room. And in each chamber was an Apis bull. But not just the bull itself. Remember, these were gods. The bulls originally had jewels on them. Right? They were bejeweled. And they were placed inside of large stone sarcophagi. Huge. The lids were about 5 tons each. Just the lid that slid on top. And the sarcophagus itself was probably up to 45 tons, I would estimate, roughly. 45 tons. These are huge things. And the idea was to keep tomb robbers out. Not easy to slide a lid like that off. Mariette found the tombs. They had all been robbed. All of them. But some of the bulls were still there, plundered, no jewels. But we have some of the Apis bulls because of Mariette's excavations. Now, the reason Mariette stopped excavating is quite a story. As he was excavating, he found a cache of amulets and small statues. Quite a number. Several hundred, we think. And he had workmen working for him, of course. And as is often the case, even in Egypt today, you make a small discovery, and immediately word gets out, it's gold. And that's what happened. The Egyptian government heard that Mariette had found gold, and they said, pack up and leave. You know, they thought he was plundering their treasures. So Marius did leave with much of what he had found in the Serapeum. But that is how the Apis bull was discovered by Auguste Mariette in the 1850s. But that is the only case where I'm willing to say an animal was mummified because it was a god. So that's one out of four reasons for mummifying an animal. Next, right? Pets. There were indeed pets that were mummified. If the next world is going to be a continuation of this one, if it's going to be basically the same, not only do you want your wife and children there, you want the dog. And the Egyptians were quite fond of pets, quite fond. It was undoubtedly upper class, of course. You know, it's like today. Farm people tend not to have normal pets. You know, they don't have cats. And they're functional. They're used to animals as being a sort of utilitarian thing. So the upper class would have cats as pets. That was quite common. They would also have baboons sometime. Right? And dogs. These were quite common. The very wealthy, princesses, people like that, could have exotic things, like gazelles. Right? And when you died, you could have your pet mummified. There's a very interesting case of the mummy of a princess that wasn't really a princess. Remember the Deir al-Bahari cache, that cache of royal mummies that were found? Well, one small mummy was included in there, and it had an inscription, and the inscription was translated. It was a difficult inscription to read, but it seemed to be the mummy of a princess. And it had her name on it. Now, it was believed to be the mummy of a princess for a long time, until X-ray came around. And then the mummy was X-rayed, and it was found to be a baboon. It wasn't a princess. It was the princess's pet. It was her pet baboon. And we also even have, for princesses, sarcophagi of gazelles, where a pet gazelle would be buried with the deceased. So one case, the second reason for mummifying an animal is as pets. There's a very, very curious one involving Theodore Davis, the American excavator in the Valley of the Kings. He was excavating, and he found a tomb that it's sometimes called the Tomb of the Baboons. There were quite a few mummies of baboons in it. But there was also one little corner. He found a baboon, mummy, mummified, and standing facing it, nose to nose, was a dog. It looks like a greyhound. It's a whippet. The Egyptians called it pharaoh hounds. And they're sort of nose to nose. And Davis wasn't sure what happened. Let me tell you what almost certainly happened. The tomb was robbed in antiquity by tomb robbers. And these guys kind of are sort of joking around inside the tomb. They've done what they can do. And one says, let's take the dog, let's take the baboon, and they put him nose to nose. That's probably how they got nose to nose. That's what I think. But anyway, the dog was probably a pet. The baboon may have been a pet. But that's another reason why animals were mummified. But most of the animals that you see today, animal mummies, were for a third reason. These were sacrifices to the gods. And that's where the Ptolemies come in. There are literally, millions of mummified animals in Egypt. It was a major industry. If you wanted, for example, to be healed, and perhaps the god you were appealing to was Imhotep, the architect of the Step Pyramid, who was deified later as the god of healing, who became Aesculapius, god of healing. If you wanted to be healed, it was like Lourdes. You would make a pilgrimage, limping, on a crutch perhaps. And when you got there, you would buy a mummified animal. Now, why a mummified animal? Well, for example, Imhotep, the animal that was special to him, sacred to him, was the ibis. The ibis. And when you got there, to the tomb of Imhotep, there were people. Now remember, this is a pilgrimage route. There would be hundreds of people each day coming, just like Lourdes, various places of healing today. As you got there, as you approached the tomb, there would be little stalls, people selling things, selling mummified ibises. And they would say, make your offering, here's a mummy of the ibis, give it to the god, and you would buy it. Now, these usually came in pots, right? They're usually in pots. And you would take the pot, which had your mummified ibis in it, go to the tomb, and you would hand it to a priest. You wouldn't be allowed inside. This was a big deal. And maybe you'd give the priest a little something, and you'd say, give it to the god that I may be healed. You could even write a little prayer with it. The priest would do it for you. Right? And then, what does the priest do with these things? Now, the priests, in general, they didn't just chuck them out. They were okay. They put them in little niches near the tomb. They had a whole cadre of the equivalent of what we would have as grave diggers. They had men who were called excellent cutters. These were men who cut out little niches in the wall and put the little mummified ibis inside that niche. Now, we have at Saqqara what is called the Ibis Gallery. It is literally miles long, underground tunnels of where, for centuries, ibises were presented as offerings to the gods. There are literally millions of ibises in these galleries. You walk, and the niches are full. And then on either side as you're walking, it's about the size of, say, a subway, an underground. On either side are piles of these ibises in pots. It must have been a major industry. Think about it. Thousands and thousands each year. We know for a fact from records. We have a wonderful cache of records by a man named Horus, who was an administrator of these galleries at Saqqara. And he would sit near the tomb, and sometimes he'd do rough drafts of his messages, of his memos. And he did them on pot shards, because that was the ancient Egyptian scrap paper. Papyrus was expensive. So if you wanted to draft something, you wrote it on a pot shard, and then you could copy it over on papyrus nicely. Well, he would do his rough draft on the pot shards, then he'd chuck them in the corner. And these pot shards were found. We call them the Archive of Hor. He was the administrator who oversaw these galleries. And you get an idea of what was going on. For example, there were ibis farms, where people would raise these ibises to be killed, and then mummified, and then sold to the pilgrims. There were large ibis farms. And one of the things he was worried about, this administrator, Hor, is that the poor pilgrims would be cheated. He was worried that people would be selling them a pot without an ibis in it. And this happened. When we examine animal mummies, we'll get a pot and we open it. And inside is the ibis mummy, ibis in quotes. Sometimes we find it's a bundle of rags and a couple of bones from different animals. Somebody, saving a little money, didn't have to buy an ibis to mummify, took the remains of yesterday's meal, wrapped some rags around it, put it in the pot, sealed it, and the poor pilgrim would never know. He thinks he's got an ibis. So Hor, our administrator, he says he wants to make sure that there is a god in every pot. That is the phrase he actually uses. It's like a chicken in every pot, you know, car in every... He wanted a god in every pot. So this was big business. This was hundreds of people producing these things. Think about it. You had people producing the wrappings. And then sometimes there were little drawings of the ibis eyes on it in gold. You could have fancy deluxe models. You could have simple ones if you were poor. But this was big business. And right next to the ibis gallery is a falcon gallery. Again, endless animal mummies. But these were all raised to be sacrificed. That's most of the animal mummies. And that was flourishing industry in Ptolemaic times. During the time of the Ptolemies, it took off. Let me tell you one other way that we know something about this industry. I mentioned cats, and that surely not every cat in the street was a god. There was a cemetery for just cats at the city, which is called Bubastis, the city of Bastet, the cat goddess. So the cat was sacred in that area, meaning the goddess who's... Bastet was the head honcho. And there's a cemetery where hundreds of thousands of these cats were buried in the ground. This wasn't a crypt in the sense, these were just put in the ground. Undoubtedly offerings again. In the 19th century, when the British were controlling Egypt, this cemetery was excavated. Now you have hundreds of thousands of these cats. What do you do with them? The British took a boatload of them. Thousands upon thousands of these mummified cats. Shipped them to England, and they were ground into the fields as fertilizer. So you had all these mummified cats ground into the fields as fertilizer. Now, of these thousands and thousands of cats that they shipped over to England, I think it's 38 sort of escaped being used as fertilizer. Were taken as scientific specimens and are now in the British Museum, in the Natural History Division, these cats. And they've been studied rather carefully. You know, now we can x-ray things. I mean, you don't have to unwrap things. You don't have to destroy it. And they've been x-rayed, these mummified cats. And two things seem to be a common denominator. First is they all died violently. These are not cats that are simply raised to old age and then you mummify it as an offering to Bastet. No. You can see that either their necks have been wrung, the vertebrae are dislocated violently, or they died, they were dispatched by being whacked on the back of the head. Their crania are often cracked. So, clearly, these aren't gods. Not at all. These were animals raised as offerings. Now, I said there were two things in common with these cat mummies. The second is, they're all very young. None of these cat mummies, you can tell from the x-ray how old the cat is, none of these cats is beyond the age of about 1 year old. Now, why? Well, think of it as a business. If you're going to raise these things to be killed as offerings, why keep it going past the presentable size? Once it's about a year old, it looks like a cat, it's not a kitten anymore, then you can have it killed and present it as an offering. So we've got these animals that are raised to be sacrificed and are then mummified and given as offerings to the gods. And you know, ibises, falcons, cats, that wasn't all. There were even fish mummies, mummies that were sacred. And at Esna, which is in southern Egypt, there was a whole cemetery of fish mummies. Now, why? Well, if you'll remember the myth of Osiris, when Osiris was hacked into pieces, only one piece was missing when Isis reassembled him, the phallus. It was thrown into the river and devoured by three fish. Well, those fish became sacred. So at Esna, there was a sacred fish cemetery. So there was a wide variety of animal mummies, but for different reasons. Now, there's one that I haven't talked about yet. Food for the deceased. And these are not so much animal mummies as parts of animals that mummified naturally in the tomb. For example, if you think about Tutankhamun's tomb, in many of the pictures of the entranceway when they first opened the tomb, you will see what looks like almost white sarcophagi, little ones, like a little bit bigger than a football. And there's stacks of them under a table, under beds. There's stacks of these white little sarcophagi. They contained ducks, pressed ducks. This was Tutankhamun's, one of his favorite meals. And when he went to the next world, he sort of took an order to go. You know, this was his meal that he was taking with him to the next world. So there are also mummified parts of animals that were to be used as food for the deceased. So really, to summarize, there are four different reasons why animals were mummified. One was as food for the deceased. Another was as a god, when the god died, like the Apis bull, the rarest. The other was these offerings, sacrificial offerings. And then there were pets taken to the next world. But during the Ptolemies, they just seemed fascinated with these animal mummies, and the sacrifices to the gods is something the Ptolemies really focused on. Now, next time, we'll pick it up with the Ptolemies and we're getting very close to the birth of Cleopatra. See you then.